welcome to another episode of Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And if you need help understanding your animal's behavior, we want to hear from you. Here's the number, 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. In addition to the calls today, we'll also discuss another topic. And what is it this time, Patricia?
We're going to take a closer look at dominance, what it is, what it isn't, and whether it's essential to good dog training.
Ooh, controversial.
Very.
And Patricia, throughout your years as a scientist who works with animals, I'm sure you've recognized how significant animals are in your understanding of biology.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, today we'll welcome a guest to the program to talk about some of the animals throughout history who've had a significant impact on how we understand biology. But first, let's take some calls. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
This is Kevin.
Kevin, where are you from?
I'm from Madison right now, but I live overseas. I'm visiting my sister over here for a little vacation, and I heard your show, and I thought you're the perfect people that can solve a problem for me.
Very cool. What's your problem?
Well, I live overseas in a large metropolitan city, and we have a lot of feral dogs running around in packs. And what has happened in my particular building is we've had a couple of people adopt some of these feral dogs, and they have now formed their own little pack of three or four dogs right in front of our building and wind up barking incessantly, defending their turf all throughout the night. And sometimes it makes it hard for you to even go back to sleep. And I want to know how we can make everybody happy, feed the dogs, make sure that they're all happy, and not have them barking, though. They're not really pets.
My mind is spinning around sort of trying to find that file recorded in there that's going to solve this problem, and it's still spinning. It's spinning and spinning and spinning, and, you know, the little disc just popped out of the computer. It's like, file not found. This is a tough one, and I really sympathize. Talk about between a rock and a hard place,
yeah.
Because these groups of feral dogs are big problems in some areas of the world. You know, South America, a lot of places, especially in Southern Europe, the West Indies, for example, feral dogs can group together and sometimes cause no problems at all. Very interesting social structure, actually. I wish there was more research being done on them, by
the
way. That
would be interesting.
There's a little bit being done, but boy, is that an opportunity to have some more research done on the behavior of them. We know a little bit. They have social relationships, but they don't form packs like wolves do. You know, they're not as tightly sort of bound together. But when you start feeding them, interacting with them, that can change their behavior as well. So now we have them starting to act like they have a resource to protect, you know, which is what dogs, you know,
sure.
Barking, territorial barking, which you don't see in wolves, by the way, very much. But so here you have this resource. Now the dogs have something to protect because the food isn't scattered sort of randomly all around the environment like it is if people aren't paying attention to them. So they're going to bark. The only thing I can think of is ask the people who have, quote, adopted them, how committed they are to these dogs. If they're really committed to them, what if there was an area in this building where the dogs could be allowed to come inside and sleep at night? Because if they're just loose outside in front of the building at night, they're going to bark. I mean, they're going to bark. You know?
Yeah.
There's sort of no way around that one. But if they were brought into the area, into a sleeping area, and then they didn't feel that they had to protect the area from other dogs or other potential competitors for the resource, then they might be quieter. So that's the best. I mean, that's what you do here in the States. Now, is that actually going to work? What country are you in, by the way?
I live in Egypt.
Okay. Is there any possibility those dogs could be brought inside?
There's not a lot of common area. The only place inside would probably be in the individual's apartment itself. Now, I must say they've been very good to these dogs. They've got them shots. They have captured them and got them shots and spayed and neutered them, and so we don't have a breeding problem. But it'll be interesting. I mean, possibly bringing in at night. I've never thought of that.
It's something to think about. See if there's any receptivity in your building about that as a possibility.
Yeah.
It's hard to half adopt a dog. You know, it's either a feral street dog or it's your dog. And and right now those dogs are living in a kind of a gray area. And so they're behaving in a kind of a gray kind of way.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, I taught at the University of the West Indies in Trinidad several years ago, and Trinidad is one of those West Indian countries that you were mentioning, Patricia, where there are dogs roaming everywhere, and it was hard to get a good night's sleep in Trinidad, I can tell you that. It's really hard.
And it's hard when you love dogs, too, to see, you know, because some of them are in really bad shape. There's no way around it. Some of them do great, but not all of them. So, yeah, it's a tricky situation.
Thanks for calling, Kevin.
Okay, well, thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. If you'd like to join in, the number to call, 1-800-462-7413. And, Patricia, we got an email question I thought you might find interesting from a listener named Eileen who'd like your opinion about this. Here's what she says. You think all dogs should go to obedience training school? I recently rescued a Westie. She's 6 months old, doing very well. My husband and I have both had dogs before, but we're wondering if you recommend obedience training for every dog. Good question.
It's a great question, and the answer might surprise some people. The answer is no, I don't.
Oh.
I do suggest that anybody go, even if they themselves have been a lot. You know, a lot of people say, I don't need to take my dog to class because I know how to train a dog. I took two other dogs to class and I know how to do it. But it's not just about you, although, as we all know, dog training class is really about being trained how to train your dog. You know,
sure.
We don't come knowing that.
Sure.
So dog training classes are one for people, but also, obviously, they're for dogs, and some dogs are overwhelmed by that situation. So I actually got a puppy, not like a rescue dog that was 2 years old and had been abandoned or anything. I got a young border collie puppy at 7 weeks who was so sound sensitive and so reactive to new things and terrified of unfamiliar dogs for a reason completely beyond me. I didn't take him to class for a really long time until he was older, and then I took him to outdoor classes where there was more room so I could sort of gradually get him used to that kind of environment. So from the person's perspective, yes, you're always better to take a dog to class because because you can practice in a distracting environment, you know, and that's a lot of what dog class is. It's like your kid goes to, you know, you don't say, well, I'm not going to send my son to basketball practice because I had another son. You know, you need to practice in that context, right? So from the person's perspective, yes, absolutely, everybody should go whenever they can. But there's some dogs, not many, maybe 5%, Larry.
Yeah.
There's some dogs who are overwhelmed by that situation and should be eased into it more slowly rather than just sort of dumped right in.
It's hard to imagine somebody with your ability and training taking a dog to a class, but I see your point.
Oh, in a minute. Absolutely. One of the ways you can distinguish a professional dog trainer is that they're in class all the time with their dog. They're always taking classes with their dog because it's about, you know, first of all, McEnroe, and does that date me or what? You know? I was going to name some famous sports athlete, and I came up with John McEnroe. But the top athletes in the world, one, have coaches. That's partly why they're good, right? Mm-hmm. But also they know that you have to practice, and that's what class is. It's practicing in a distracting environment.
Yeah.
And you know what? It's fun, too. It's really fun. Good classes are really fun.
Well, I guess if you can do it, and Tiger Woods can do it, and John McEnroe did it,
there you go.
I guess we could all do it. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Here's another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, Larry and Patricia. This is Jill from Tallahassee.
Jill from Tallahassee, Florida, I'll bet. Thank you for calling, Jill. What can we do for you?
Well, I've got a real problem with my cat and really need some advice because he's driving me insane. I've owned many cats over the years, and this is a behavior that has I've never seen before. My cat's name is Paul Newman, and he's about a year old. I got him when he was 8 weeks old at the local shelter, and I don't know what his circumstances were in those first 8 weeks of life, but, you know, I've provided a very loving home for him. He's very affectionate. He follows me everywhere in the house. He's a beautiful cat, long-haired and very silky soft and with a beautiful plume of a tail. And I can't help but, you know, want to pet him, and he'll purr, and he rubs his little nose.
Can I make a wild guess about what your problem is?
Ask.
Does he bite you?
Yes.
Yeah.
He doesn't just bite. He doesn't nibble. He just turns around and attacks me and breaks the skin, and his pupils get large.
Mm-hmm.
And if I make eye contact with him, he'll try to attack my face.
Ooh.
He tries to attack the side of my head. If I say no, that makes him very angry. I really love my cat, and I know that deep down he loves me back.
Oh, he does, I'm sure.
But I don't have a clue what to do with him.
Oh, this is a tricky one, partly because it sounds so serious, you know. The reason I threw that guess out there is you described the typical environment for a cat who tends to get bitey, especially during a petting session. Often it happens.
Yeah.
You start to pet them, and here's the demographics. It's young,
uh-huh.
It's male. Sorry, Larry.
No.
It's just what it is.
And, he's been neutered, but...
And it's a cat who can't go outside.
Oh, so goodness. So he is mad at me.
No. Not at all.
No, it's not about anger. It's about the fact this cat has huge amounts of energy.
Uh-huh.
And he's also, remember, cats are barely domesticated animals. Part of the fun, part of what we think of the sort of the mystery and the independence of cats is actually based on the fact that they're really barely domesticated animals. You have a wild cat living in your house, and they can switch from play to predation extremely fast.
Oh,
extremely fast. So here are a couple of things you can try, because it sounds like you really love Paul. He must have blue eyes.
He did, and that's how he got his name, but they have changed.
They changed. You know, so Paul has turned into, I don't know, some, you know, not so nice.
I thought maybe he had an affinity for salad dressing or something.
he is extremely handsome, though. He remains extremely handsome.
That's it. Feed him salad dressing and, you know, popcorn. So here's some ideas for you. One is we got to get this cat more exercise. Lots and lots and lots of exercise. So lots of toys on, like, fishing poles where you keep him away from you. I want you to initiate it. Don't wait for him. When he starts, he's like, I'm desperate. You know, I want you to initiate lots and lots of physical activity.
Okay.
I also want you to get his mind busy, because that's one of the things that indoor cats suffer from. The other thing I want you to do, and this is hard, is I want you to be very thoughtful about when and how you pet him.
Okay.
Because it's the petting so often that sets these cats off. So one, no prolonged stroking. You'll be pet, pet, and then I want you to quit.
Okay.
If he starts getting really pushy, pushy, rubby, 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 I want you to withdraw a little bit. I don't want you to pet him too much, and just try and distract him and get him doing something else, okay?
Yeah, good luck.
Okay. Thank you so much for your advice. I appreciate you.
All right. Jill, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. What does it really mean if your dog is dominant toward other dogs? We'll find out next. I'm Larry Mailer with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers a variety of information, including online archives of the show, pet tips, Patricia's dog training books, and the opportunity to submit email questions. The website is callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mailer with Patricia McConnell. And Tricia, it seems like there's a resurgence in talking about dominance in dog training. People like Cesar Millan say that getting dominance over your dog is essential to good training. Is that true?
Well, you know, there's a lot of what Cesar says that I like, but I don't agree with him about this issue about getting dominance over your dog.
Yeah.
And you know, that term dominance, it is so loaded.
Yeah.
It is probably the most misunderstood word in dog training, first of all. It's so misused that I know lots of trainers and behaviorists, they won't even use it anymore.
So help us understand, what is dominance anyway?
Well, you know, it's actually, as properly used, it's really simple. Dominance is, quote, priority access to limited resources.
Okay.
Priority access to limited resources. In other words, you've got two dogs with a bone in between them. Who gets it?
Who gets it?
Whoever gets it is dominant.
Okay.
That's all dominance was ever supposed to mean. And what researchers found, they actually set up this exact situation in the laboratory. They had two dogs. They put a bone in between them. And what they found when they did this day after day is that the relationship between the dogs was stable, is that if dog A gets it, the bone on the first day, then he'll get it the second day and the third day. That in most cases, these relationships tend to be stable. But here's what it doesn't tell you, and this is really important. It doesn't tell you how they got the bone. So a dog could have gotten it. There could have been a skirmish between the two dogs, or there could have just been posturing. One dog's tail goes up, the other dog slinks away. Another thing to keep in mind is that dominance is very context related. So we've got these two dogs in a laboratory room with a bone. That's who wins that bone doesn't necessarily tell you what's going to happen in different contexts. Context is very important when you're looking at these social relationships.
So how relevant is dominance then when we're training our dogs?
Not very. It's not very important. Most disobedience has to do with other things. You know, the dog was confused. He didn't know what you meant. Or you never really taught him why he should do it. Keep in mind that dogs don't use dominance to force other dogs to do things. They use it to give themselves priority access to something they want. You know, so you can't get a dog to come to you by being dominant because that's not what it is. It has nothing to do with those things.
Well, does that mean that dogs aren't pack animals that have relationships based on social status?
Well, now there's a good controversy. It depends on who you ask, but I'll tell you my opinion. My opinion is that without question, social status, sort of who's who, is very much relevant in canine society. But I don't think our dogs sort of need to be dominant in the often aggressive way that it's used. I think dogs need us, as their humans, not to be dominant, but to be what I call benevolent leaders, like good parents, you know, good teachers who provide guidance and boundaries. It's up to us to teach them that they can get what they want by being patient and polite, not by throwing their weight around. And we shouldn't throw our weight around either.
No. I tell you what, just as dogs depend on us, who do we depend on?
Oh, let me think.
Our listeners?
I think that might be true.
I do too. And by the way, if you have a question for us, I hope you'll call in right now at 1-800-462-7413. Let's see who's waiting for us now. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Douglas in Dallas, Texas.
Hi, Doug. Thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
I had a question if pets have any concept of medicine. I've been wrestling my cat for the past couple of weeks, forcing them some prescribed antibiotics, and I was wondering if they even understand that, you know, it's in their best interest and the shots we give them and whatnot are not just some kind of cruel act that humans do to animals.
Oh, that's such an interesting question.
That's a great question.
You know, that's a kind of an abstraction, that concept that you take something and it's going to make you feel better later on, and those two things are sort of not related in any way, really, contextually. That's a lot of abstractions. So can
I,
you know,
feel like eat around the pill if I hide it in the food and stuff, and I don't know when I force them the liquids or you know, force the pill down there if he knows that that's medicine and that's... He's getting better from it.
I can tell you that in terms of anecdotes and impressions anyway, I sure have had a lot of animals who certainly didn't seem to get the concept. I'm sorry, honey. but that's one of the contexts in which I wish we could talk to our pets, don't you?
It's
I'm so sorry. This is to make you feel better. I'm taking you to the vet. You're getting the surgery. I'm giving you this pill every day. I think most of the times they don't. But, you know, there are anecdotes that suggest that there might be exceptions to that. I've heard stories from people, and granted, they're just stories, but I think, you know, we shouldn't discount reality as it happens, and it at least gives us something to think about. I've certainly heard stories of people who had, like, a badly injured animal who put up with things they shouldn't seem to have been wanting to put up with, for example, or animals who change their behavior based on whether some medicine was helping them or not. I have actually myself had an animal who rejected one medicine that I finally figured out was making her horribly sick. She sort of put up with getting pills put down her mouth, except for this one pill, and she started fighting and fighting and fighting. And I finally figured out, actually, I went online and I talked to my vet, and one of the side effects of this medicine is it made them horribly nauseous, and I stopped giving it to her, and she was like...
And she knew which pill.
And she seemed to know which pill. So it's a really, we do not know the answer to your question, but I do want to acknowledge it as a really good one.
Well, at least some people have seen it.
Thanks, Doug.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call very much. 1-800-462-7413, our number. Hello, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Kristen. I'm calling from Anchorage, Alaska.
Hi, Kristen. What can we do for you?
Okay, so my puppy is a little bit over a year old, and my boyfriend and I would really like to train him to be able to stay alone and guard the house when we are out, but we're a little fearful because of his past track record. Basically, he was a big chewer as a puppy. He got into anything and everything, which we just assumed was typical puppy behavior, and he got a little bit older. The chewing became less consistent, but even more destructive and expensive. Typically, he'd go about a week and not chew anything, and we would assume he had outgrown the behavior, and then he would chew something up again.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my question is, how do I correct my dog's behavior when I'm not here to catch him in the act? And how do I know when he's ready to be trusted alone in the house? And how can I help him make this transition?
Those are really, really good questions. There are a lot of answers, actually. Let me ask you one more question, though. How old exactly is he, and what breed are we talking about?
He is a year and 3 months, almost 3 months.
Okay.
So I think he's still a puppy, and he's a shepherd mix. We think he's a German shepherd lab mix. He's not too big. He's about 50 pounds, 55 pounds.
Okay, and the lab gets my ears pricked up because this is a breed who was designed to use his mouth all the time.
Mm-hmm.
15 months is very young. You're absolutely right. You know, he's an adolescent now. I actually have a dog just about that same age who's in a crate as we speak. And would I leave my dog alone all day long? Not a chance. Not a microsecond yet. He's just not ready to do that.
Okay.
I do want you to go online, maybe go to Amazon, go to Wisconsin Public Radio. And
I've read your stuff on separation anxiety.
Oh, good.
Yes, very helpful.
I was going to suggest, I do want you to be clear about whether this is separation anxiety related or do you just have a young dog who's chewing a lot. So one, he's not ready to take out of the crate yet.
Okay.
Do be sure, sounds like you've done this, but for other people listening in a similar situation, you definitely want to look to see, is this separation anxiety or is it just a young dog chewing? And the way, in answer to your question about transitioning, is what you do, you go slow. You don't go from in the crate all day to loose all day.
Okay.
You go from, let's see, I'm going to leave the dog loose in the house while I go to get the mail.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to leave the dog loose in the house after he's really tired and he has two hollow stuffed toys stuffed with food on the floor, and I'm going to drive to the Quick Mart and be back in 10 minutes.
Okay.
And then you do that for a month or so, and then you leave him maybe for a half an hour. But, you know, for labs, I asked a retriever breeder once how old her dogs had to be before she would leave them loose in the house, and she said 3.
Oh, wow.
3 years
okay.
old.
So, yeah, so don't feel badly.
I'm probably pushing it, yeah.
Yeah, you might be pushing
it
a little bit.
I didn't know, you know, they teach you to start training your dog at a very young age. You know, you start teaching them immediately. But this is obviously something that is just going to, we're going to need to wait till he's past his chewing stage.
That's right. You know, you start teaching them to come and sit when they're 7 weeks old, but you can't expect them to do graduate school work when they're in elementary school.
Okay.
Good luck.
Okay, great.
Thanks a lot for calling, Kristen. You know, you and I are kind of like Labradors, aren't we? We're trained to use our mouth. We talk, although we talk. We don't chew up the furniture. I guess that's the difference.
Well, I don't. I don't know about you, Mueller.
No, I don't.
I'll talk to Renee, your wife.
Oh, man. I tell you what, if you'd like to join in, if you've got a question you'd like to mouth to us, give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. Coming up next, from fruit flies to the Onco mouse, meet the animals who help biology evolve. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers you the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and find out when Patricia will be in a city near you. Information online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are also available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and today we welcome Jim Endersby to the program. Jim is a lecturer in the history department at the University of Sussex and the author of the book, A Guinea Pig's History of Biology. Jim Endersby, welcome to the program. Why did you think it was important to write a book about the history of biology?
Well, it's what I do, and usually when the history of science of any form is explained to a lay audience, it tends to be told as a series of geniuses, one lone genius after another who, you know, changed the world. And history, to me, doesn't look much like that. I wanted to try and tell the story in a way that gave a flavour of the sheer hard work of doing science, and of all the people who make up the scientific work who are not usually celebrated, whose names are not usually known, and of course the animals and plants who made biology possible, seemed an interesting way to pull those ideas together.
You know, one of the things that struck me reading your book is that we don't teach the history of science much in school anymore. Do you think there's something lost by that?
I certainly do. I mean, the little bit that you get is usually the science teacher telling you one of the kind of famous stories about some great figure who did some great thing. And those stories are often at best simplistic and at worst wrong. And I do think, you know, I was the kind of, when I was at school, you really had to choose between science and the humanities and the arts. And I found it very hard to choose. And I ended up going with the humanities and then always regretting having lost the science side of things. And the history of science, when I discovered it much later in life, was the perfect marriage for me of these things. Because most of us, we need to know something about science. It's everywhere and it affects everything around us. And it's very hard for us to get to grips with the technicalities of genetic engineering or stem cell research or whatever it happens to be. The history is a good way into that. It gives us a sense of what science is like, what kind of questions it can ask, and what kind of questions it can't answer. So I think it would be very good to have more of it in schools, and even in universities. It's a very small subject. It would be nice to have more of it there, too.
And when we look back at the history of science, we see something as simple as the fruit fly playing an important role. Tell us why fruit flies were initially so important to early 20th century biologists.
It began almost by accident when a biologist called Castle was looking for an organism that could sustain repeated inbreeding. This is crossing animals that are closely related to each other. In many species, such as ourselves, if you do this too much, you get a lot of what we would now know as genetic defects showing up. And it turned out that fruit flies were able to resist this for a long period, so they were very useful for certain kinds of experiments. But the real reason that they became popular was simply that they were very small and very cheap. And the man who is most associated with bringing them into biology, Thomas Hunt Morgan, had a laboratory at Columbia, uptown Manhattan. Space obviously at a premium in Manhattan, then as now. He had a student who wanted to do some research, and the place was already crawling, literally, with pigeons and rats and mice and frogs and everything else you can think of. And Morgan said, yeah, okay, you can do this, but find something small, really small. And so they literally put a rotting banana out on a windowsill, waited for some Drosophila, some fruit flies to appear, caught them, and that was the start of the research program. So biology is often driven by, all science is driven by very practical concerns. How much money do we have? How much space do we have? How can we make the best use of our resources?
And sometimes by happenstance, I remember the scientist who went home and saw his wife doing some jam or something, and that was a great story, and you have many stories like that, but maybe you could just tell that story.
This was about agar gel becoming used in biology labs to grow bacteria and things on. And it just so happened that one of the researchers, as you say, his wife had been raised in the Far East. And agar, which is derived from seaweed, is used in Indonesian and Southeast Asian cooking. It wasn't well known in America at the time. And it has this interesting property, which is that it doesn't melt when it gets hot. So in hot weather, the gelatin that they were using before would liquefy and decay, wouldn't be any use for the research. And he just got this inspiration watching her cooking and thought, ah, that's what I need. And that is now the standard stuff on thousands and thousands of petri dishes in laboratories all over the world.
Millions, probably.
Tens of millions, yeah, who knows.
There are also some great stories about guinea pigs in your book, you know, and there's a reason why we use the term guinea pig as somebody being sort of an experimental animal. Tell us a little bit about why guinea pigs were ultimately so significant in the history of science.
again, it's one of those things that starts by accident. They were first domesticated in the Andes, and they're one of very few South American mammals to be domesticated. And they were domesticated for food. I mean, I hate to alarm any of your visitors who have pet guinea pigs that they love, but that's what they were for originally. And they were kept in people's houses. They were fed on scraps. When they got big enough and fat enough, they were eaten. And, of course, if you're going to keep an animal like that, you don't want anything that's too fast, too aggressive, or too skinny. So gradually, basically, people selected the guinea pigs that were nice and slow and placid and gentle. And because they had those qualities, they made rather nice children's pets. And sailors started bringing them back to Europe as pets for children, precisely because they didn't bite, they didn't scratch, and they didn't run away. And those qualities made them an attractive organism for experiments. Nice and docile, not too aggressive. Antoine Lavoisier, the French chemist, was probably the first person to use them in an experiment on respiration, where he was measuring breathing and the heat of an animal, trying to understand the relationship between respiration and combustion and the way oxygen is used up. And then they had a long and at times very sad career in the laboratory. Again, they're quite small, they breed quite quickly, they're nice and easy to look after. And then it, you know, they have various twists in the tale that, sorry, guinea pigs don't have tails, but the tale of the guinea pig. It turns out, for example, that research was done on scurvy. Sailors would get scurvy on long voyages. It was known that certain kinds of foods would prevent it. So famously, British sailors were given lime juice, which is why you occasionally still refer to us as limeys. And lime juice would keep the scurvy at bay, but it turned out that sometimes it didn't work as well as others. Some limes didn't work as well as others. Researchers started looking into this to try and find out what is it that makes it work? What is scurvy? What causes it? How do we prevent it? And they did experiments with pigeons and rats and didn't get any useful results from that. And they did find that guinea pigs were the useful things to work on because guinea pigs, like us, cannot make vitamin C themselves. And it turned out that vitamin C was the key to scurvy. It's a deficiency disease. Pigeons and rats can actually make their own vitamin C from their diet. So they were useless to do experiments on because nobody knew that until they'd tried and failed. So the guinea pigs have actually proven themselves very useful to a whole lot of research, saved a huge number of lives, human lives, and been involved in the winning of more than 20 Nobel Prizes in various forms.
Interesting. You also talk about how difficult it is to study some animals, in particular fish, are tough because they live and breathe underwater. How were scientists able to make advancements in embryological research using zebrafish?
The story was that George Streisinger, who was a biologist at the University of Oregon at Eugene, was one of a number of people who'd been involved in pioneering research, but mostly using bacteria and viruses, where some of the basic workings of DNA and genes had been solved using very, very simple organisms. And he was one of a number of people who thought, well, where do we go from here? We need to do other things and find out how the genes work in more complex organisms. And it turned out to be much trickier than he'd expected. And he was very lucky to be at the University of Oregon, which had a very nice, the people who've been there describe it as being having a kind of a 60s atmosphere, a touch of the kind of hippie idealism about it. So the people whose research were going well would subsidize George's research out of their budgets because he wasn't getting anywhere and he wasn't getting any publications. It was hard for him to get more grants. So they would help him out while he got the kinks out of the system and got the fish breeding properly and thriving and was able to then start doing research. And they have become one of the most important organisms in laboratories in the world as a result largely of his pioneering work. And it was very much a one-man show when he started. It's now a huge community. But all the people who work on the fish still say, you know, George was the man. He died a few years ago very unexpectedly and is still much missed by the community.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, right now there's so much going on in science. The history books are going to be very fat mm-hmm. not too long from now. And as is usually true, there's a lot of controversy about some of the things that are going on right now. I know one of them you talk about is the oncomouse that is very controversial, both in the public and in scientists. Tell us about an oncomouse. What is it? And how did you react when you first heard about it?
Well, this was the first non-human organism to have a human gene implanted into it. As you probably know, it's been discovered that there are certain genes that predispose people to getting certain illnesses. They don't cause the illness, but they massively increase your chance of getting it. And the ones that increase your chance of getting cancer are called oncogenes. And obviously, to try and look for cures for cancer and treatment for cancer, it was very useful to find mice that were susceptible to cancer so that you could see how well a particular treatment could prevent the cancer. If you knew you had a mouse with an elevated chance of getting the cancer in the first place, you could really see how effective your treatment was as a first step towards testing a new drug or a new therapy. But, you know, cancers are relatively rare in most strains of mice, so they used genetic engineering techniques to put this gene into the mouse to develop a mouse that was going to get cancer. And there is a certain, what in Britain we talk about as the yuck factor, when you think about human DNA being put into a non-human animal. And it makes me uneasy, it makes most people uneasy. But then you've got to think about what are the alternatives. We had a drug trial here which had made headlines around the world of six healthy young men almost killed by a drug that was they were being tested, they volunteered to have tested on them. You don't want to play too many games with people's lives when you're testing new therapies and new drugs. Nobody wants to see animals suffer unnecessarily, but nor do you want to see, your children, your parents, the people you love, dying of cancer unnecessarily. And cancer survival rates are massively better than they were 40, 50 years ago because of research done on animals. So I think it's ethically a very difficult issue.
Jim, you're a historian, but I want to ask you to look ahead to the future a little bit. Given the recent advancements in biological research, where do you think the use of animals in research is headed?
I think that I hope that we're going to see a reduction in the use of animals. And I think that we should feel a profound, all of us feel a profound sense of gratitude to the mice and the guinea pigs and the other animals who have taught us so much, entirely unreluctantly, it has to be said. And that we should show our gratitude by finding ways to eliminate animals from research as much as possible. And a lot of effort is going into this. And some of the biological advances we've made with the help of animals should allow us to eliminate their use in laboratories in the future. So producing tissue cultures and artificial growing organs in the laboratory and so on will allow us to do certain kinds of tests without actually having to use live animals for them. And I hope we'll see a lot more of that, a lot more of computer modeling to give us a first idea of how a drug is going to behave and so on before we expose animals to it. So it's hard to predict, but I think there will be a need for animals in medical research, particularly for the foreseeable future. I hope we'll see a diminution of it as other ways of testing and experimenting come in. And it has to be said, there's a real drive in science to save money, and keeping a lot of animals healthy and clean and in good order is very expensive.
Yeah.
That has driven the rise of the zebrafish too, because they're much cheaper than mice, let alone primates. So,
Jim, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Not at all. Thank you for asking me.
Jim Andersby is the author of A Guinea Pig's History of Biology. He joined us today from the studios of BBC Southern Counties in Sussex, England. Don't go away. Our animal trivia question of the week is next with your chance to win a copy of Jim's book. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you missed an episode of Calling All Pets, the show is available online. Our website offers archives of the show, along with the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and learn more about a guest you heard on the program. More information available online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
You're listening to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And now it's time for our animal trivia question of the week. If you think you know the answer to this week's question, call our 800 number or send an email to pets@wpr.org. All correct guessers will have their names pulled together, and two winners will be selected at random to win a copy of A Guinea Pig's History of Biology by Jim Andersby. And here's today's question. In his book, Jim talks about an animal called the quagga, which is kind of a zebra. And just like the passenger pigeon and the Tasmanian tiger, we know the exact date the quagga went extinct. It's August 12th. 1883. Unlike a zebra, which has stripes across its entire body, the quagga only had stripes where? If you think you know the answer, call our 800 number or send an email to pets@wpr.org. And to find out if you're correct, visit callingallpets.org. We'll have the correct answer posted online in about a week. And right now, we'll take some more calls at 1-800-462-7413. And let's see who's next. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hello. My name is Saul. I live in Anchorage, Alaska. My daughter has an 18-month-old yellow lab female named Maggie, and she's a very sweet dog. We walk her off-leash at a local dog park, and she's very fine and wonderful with other dogs. But here's the problem. Very often, when someone is approaching us, maybe the person is about 30 feet away, Maggie starts barking. And when they approach us, they're usually not associated with any other dog. And she gets into a high-pitched bark, and at times she will actually get up on her hind legs and seems to be hopping towards them. She doesn't growl at them. She doesn't lunge. And the moment they pass us, it's over. Because it's been so cold here, they're usually bundled up. If it's people, you know, people walking towards us, they're bundled up in heavy coats and hats. And, you know, many of them, they don't seem to mind, but others seem to be somewhat intimidated, and we don't quite know what to do because Maggie's off-leash, and she won't stop or when we call her.
Do you have any idea? Well, let me ask it this way. If the people don't keep walking past, if they, on the other hand, walk right up to Maggie and say, "Hi, dog, how are you?" What does Maggie do? Does she go right to them enthusiastically, wagging from the shoulders back? Does she lean back a tiny bit? Does she run back to you? What does she do?
She goes towards them and sniffs them, but she doesn't get friendly with them.
Okay.
But she actually will stop barking.
I would start a counter-conditioning program if she was my dog. I would set up situations where you ask your buddies to go out with you to the dog park. Maybe you could ask five of them and take them all out to breakfast afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And what I want you to do is I want you to have her favorite treats in the pocket of each of those people. But they're going to disperse throughout the dog park. And what they're going to do is walk towards you. And even when Maggie's barking at them, I want them to toss a treat in her direction. I don't want them to try and go right up to her or make her take the treat from their hand, which is what people most want to do, by the way. And even when they say, "Oh, no, no, it's okay, I'm not afraid," you want to say, "But it's not about you." You know, just stay where you are and underhand it like you're a pitcher or something. Toss the treats on the ground. Let her eat it on the ground. Because what I want her to learn is that I love it when people come up. I love it when people come up. Now, you might end up with a different problem, which is her running up to people in the dog park and mugging them for food. Hello, hello.
We already have that problem.
Does she do that already?
When there are people who are associated with other dogs, and Maggie seems to sense when they have treats for their own dogs in her pocket.
Sure.
She's at them.
Sure, she's a lab and her nose works very well. And she's learned, too. Dog people
right.
have treats. And a lot of dogs who are uncomfortable with unfamiliar people are more comfortable when the approaching person has a dog beside them.
Yeah.
So I would institute that program I talked about. But here's something else that I think is really, really important. I want you to think about having the consequences of having your dog off-leash outside when she won't come when you call, when she's excited or distracted or anxious. So I really want you to work on that. And you can start with, you know, start with a long line as a kind of a backup safety system. Put on a regular leash and a long, light line, and then very ostentatiously take off the leash and say, "Okay." And then work on making coming when called a really fun game. It's the most fun game in the world. Call her to come, run the other way, treat, 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 throw your ball. Work on it at home, work on it in the backyard, work on it everywhere she's a little distracted. Maybe even get a trainer to help you. But I'm uncomfortable with you having your dog outside loose when she's not listening when she needs to. So I would mm-hmm. work on that really hard, too.
Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks all for calling. Appreciate it very much. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call if you'd like to join in. And let's see who's next. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Well, thank you for taking my call. My name is Russell, and I live, strangely enough, in Madison, Wisconsin.
All right, Russell.
About 3 years ago, my wife and I adopted two cats. Winston Churchill and Anastasia. In fact, I called you about Anastasia. She's recovered quite well from fear aggression.
Good.
This concerns Winston. Approximately a month ago, he started what I would describe as a kneading ritual. It takes place at night. The cats sleep on our bed. And he begins, he gets a glazed look on his face.
Mm-hmm.
He begins to knead intensively.
Mm-hmm.
And should you attempt to interrupt his reverie by petting him, for instance, he gets very disturbed, and he will either jump off the bed and disperse, or he'll grab his sister by the neck.
Oh, dear.
And, you know. Now, both of the cats were neutered when we got them. And
okay.
We've had cats for 40 years, and I've seen kneading before, but I've never seen this.
Okay. And it just started a month ago. How old is Winston?
Well, Winston's about 5 years old. They both are.
What's interesting about this, and the caller points it out, is that it just started a month ago. You know, kneading is so common. I have a dog who does it, and a lot of cats do it. It's what we think it is. It's certainly a throwback to behavior you see in kittens and puppies when they're actually nursing. And the kneading behavior is what helps the milk let down. And animals seem to go into a trance-like state. That's very, very common. What we think it is a kind of an action that actually increases one of the calming neurotransmitters, probably serotonin, most likely, but there are a lot of other, that's the one that's best known, but there are a lot of other neurotransmitters that could be involved too. But it's a sort of a self-soothing, internally medicating, legal drug.
He does seem to be medicated.
Yeah, it really changes an animal's mood. But what's interesting to me is why is he doing it now? Usually this is a behavior that's relatively consistent. Animals do it all their life to some extent, and other times they don't. I can use it as a mood indicator of my Border Collie Lassie, is that she, when she gets anxious, she does it more often.
Mm.
So I wouldn't worry about the behavior itself, but I would ask you to sort of sit down and think, has anything changed? Are there new smells coming into the house? Is anybody in the house working with new animals outside the house?
There is
You're
a
laughing.
Change.
Oh, what is
there
it?
There is a change. We were having extensive remodeling of the house. So we had workers in the house and things of that sort.
Uh-huh.
So perhaps that's an explanation. I wasn't all that disturbed by the behavior, but I was very curious.
Yeah. It's very interesting, isn't it? It's so intense when you see it.
Oh,
it's like, wow.
We've had other cats that have kneaded before, but I've never seen this kind of, you know, trance-like behavior. And he was very regular about it. He would do it at the same time every night.
Well, take a photograph of Winston and send it to our website, WPR.org. And we'll put it on the website. We can all see a picture of Winston kneading away.
Well, thank you very much for the information.
Thanks, Russell. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Patricia, we got an email question in from Dolly in Two Rivers, Wisconsin. She's wondering about her cats named Duchess and Mindy, and here's what she writes. About 11 years ago, I adopted two shelter cats that were estimated to be about 2 years old. During the first 8 years, Duchess would purr on a regular basis, but I never, not even once, heard Mindy purr.
Okay.
Unfortunately, Duchess died when she was around 10 years old. About a month later, Mindy started to purr. She's been purring on a regular basis ever since. Up until then, I just assumed that some cats purr and others simply don't. So, Patricia, Dolly wants to know, did Mindy not purr because Duchess purred for the both of them? Was this a dominance issue? And come to think of it, why the heck do cats purr at all?
Oh, what a bunch of good questions. You know, this. The first thing I want to say is this phenomenon of thinking you know your pets, and then one disappears, and then the other one becomes somebody else. I mean, that happened to me. I had two cats years and years ago, and one, very sadly to say, disappeared in the wilds of Alaska. I'm happy to say that he came back in a month. It was a very happy day for me. But for that month, my other cat, Lufa, who I had always thought was aloof, she just wasn't a cuddly cat. She's aloof. She didn't really want to be petted very much. Wrong. As soon as Shaw disappeared, my other cat, she was all over me. So her behavior was being strongly influenced by the other cat. So it's very probable that the fact that Minnie wasn't purring very much had to do with Duchess, and the fact that that started related to Duchess's death. Now, exactly what that means, you know, is she happier? Is she more relaxed? And that leads to the big question of why do cats purr? And here's the answer, and it's very definitive. We actually know now from extensive research, we don't know. We don't know. We have absolutely no idea. Although what we do know is that there are tissues in the cat's larynx that, if they're relaxed in a certain way, it's like snoring in a way. If there's a certain relaxation of certain muscle groups, then you get that sort of really quiet. Well, not quiet. Some cats are really noisy.
Some are noisy. Yes.
You get that purring sound. But we also know that cats can do it sometimes when they're in pain. Cats will do it while they're delivering their kittens, for example. So we're actually still, that's one of those many mysteries that cats have brought along with them to our lives. Sort of like mystery.
And if we find out the answer to that mystery by next week, we could talk about it.
We certainly, and you know, well, maybe somebody out there knows. If you have some ideas about what you know or what you think about why cats purr, send us an email. Send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
And thank you very much for listening today. Patricia McConnell is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And she's here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Calling All Pets is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0301P. More pet tips and advice for training new dogs or leaving pets home alone are available online at callingallpets.org. Our website also features a complete list of past guests and online archives of the program. The website, once again, is callingallpets.org.